And our talk tonight is about the holiday of Hanukkah. Those of you that come from the United States may remember there's a phenomenon in the United States, maybe other countries as well, that is called the December Dilemma. And that is because of the other holiday, December 25th of the other religion. So Jews often felt left out, they felt excluded, they felt they weren't connected. So as a result, the less religious community made a very big deal about Hanukkah, making Hanukkah equal to the other holiday. Then there was a counter-reaction in which, no, Hanukkah's not so important and one shouldn't make it equal to December 25th and the like. But by and large, for a religious person, this is a very empty debate, because when you're connected to Hashem and you have your religion, we have Torah, we have mitzvos, we have Dveikus in Hashem, so let other people do whatever their other people are doing. I mean, with my nafkamina, they can do what they're doing. I don't have to bring a lawsuit to stop whatever things they're doing, because we're connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And what I want to communicate tonight is that, yes, it is very true that Hanukkah is not of the same magnitude as the Shalosh Regalim and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but Hanukkah is an enormously important zman, an amazingly important lesson, and one that really helps us in dealing with a secular, turbulent world. Hanukkah is not so much about the issues of war and peace that, unfortunately, we face every day in Eretz Yisrael, but Hanukkah is totally about assimilation and being connected to foreign cultures, and therefore it is much more about assimilation than it is about milchama. And this point is actually made by the Levush, Rav Mordechai Yaffe, one of the great poskim who lived in Poland in the 1500s. He points out that how come on Purim, which celebrates a salvation of the Jewish people, we celebrate in a physical way. We're mechuyev to have a meal, we drink wine, we have shalach manas, food, and the like. But Hanukkah is really celebrated only in spirit. There is no chiyuv to have latkes, the minhag of there, sufganiyot even, the minhag of oil is a minhag. There is no chiyuv to have a meal on Hanukkah. Hanukkah is celebrated with halal. Hanukkah is celebrated with hadlakas haneros. These are mitzvos that reflect ruchnias, not gashmias. Why is Purim celebrated begashmias and Hanukkah celebrated beruchnias? So the Levush explains that the danger we faced in Purim was really a danger to the body, not a danger to the soul. Haman was like Hitler. Hitler didn't care if you were religious or not religious, right? In fact, there were Jews who unfortunately converted to Christianity who died in the concentration camp. And one of them is a saint, Edith Stein. It was a very controversial issue. Edith Stein converted to Catholicism in 1922. She died in Auschwitz in 1941, I believe. The Catholic Church recently canonized her as a martyr to the church. Now obviously she's not a martyr to the church because she didn't die because she was a Catholic, she died because she was a Jew, but it underscores the idea that Hitler didn't care about from or not from. Haman didn't care about from or not from. Haman wanted to destroy the Jewish people absolutely, physically from the face of the earth. So the Hatzalah of Purim was a Hatzalah from the danger of the body. And therefore we thank Hashem with our bodies, with our physical selves. Hanukkah was very different. It is true that Hanukkah did involve a war. And it is true that there was a nitzachon in that war. And it's true that Jews' lives were in danger. But the only reason there was a war is because the Jews, well, actually most of the Jews did assimilate, but because the small, courageous minority known as the Hashmonaim and the people who joined the Hashmonaim, they refused to give up their allegiance to Torah and mitzvos. Antiochus, you know, from a totally secular standpoint, you could say Antiochus was a big civil libertarian. Antiochus was perfectly happy to give Jews full civil and political rights. He was not anti-Semitic in the Hitler sense, but he wanted Jews to give up their distinct mitzvos that separate them from general society. Give up Shabbos. Give up Bris Mila, which physically, you know, differentiates you. Give up Kashrus. Give up the study of Torah. Become a Hellenist. Enjoy the athletic games. And if a Jew did that, they could survive. They could flourish. They were given admission. So Hanukkah was about a danger to Ruchnius, not a danger to Gashmius. And as a result, the Levush says, when we celebrate Hashem liberating us and giving us a Yeshua, since the danger was a spiritual danger, we celebrate in a spiritual way by lighting Neros. It was not a danger to the guf, it was a danger to the neshama, and Neros themselves are a remez to the neshama, as the Pasuk says, Ner Hashem, Nishmat Adam, the soul of a person is a candle lit from the Almighty. So that's very important to understand. Yes, Hanukkah did have a war. Hanukkah did have casualties, but it was a war that was fought totally because of spiritual ideals. It was not intrinsically a physical threat to our survival. This is a point that is made by the Levush. This also explains something very peculiar about Hanukkah, which is really a much, much longer talk. I'll just allude to it briefly. And that is, it's been pointed out that the Mishnah, now the Hanukkah story, just to get your chronology straight, the Hanukkah story occurred in the middle of the Second Temple period, and the approximate year is around 185 to 185 before the Common Era. Before the Common Era, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed later by the Romans in around the year 70 of the Common Era. So you're talking about the story of Hanukkah is 250 years before the Churban of the Bayis Sheni. Now the Mishnah of Rav Yehuda HaNasi was written after the Churban and even after the Bar Kokhba revolt, and the date that we normally give for the finishing of the Mishnah, these are all approximate dates, is the year 200 of the Common Era. In other words, 130 years after the Churban. So how many years, I don't want to give you mathematic problems, 8:15 at night, but how many years after the Hanukkah story was the Mishnah written? Around 300 years, or almost 400 years, right? Because from 185 BCE to 200 Common Era is almost 400 years. So by the time the Mishnah was written, the holiday of Hanukkah was very, very well established. And yet, one of the mysteries that commentaries point out is how little the Mishnah talks about the Hanukkah story. We have a whole Maseches about Purim and every other Yom Tov, basically, except for Shavuos, because Maseches Shavuos is not about Shavuos, although it has 49 blot, interesting point. But Hanukkah is only mentioned in the Mishnah one time, and it's not even mentioned directly. It's a really kind of a crazy case. The Mishnah Bava Kamma discusses what if I have a camel, and on the camel's back there's long pieces of flax, and the flax goes into somebody's store and it gets ignited by a lantern, and the camel keeps on walking and sets fire to a building, and the building burns down. Who's chayef to pay for the building? The owner of the camel or the owner of the store? And the Gemara basically says, if the light was inside the store, the owner of the camel is liable. If the light was outside the store, the owner of the light is liable. He shouldn't have lit outside the store. But the Mishnah says, but if it was a Hanukkah light that you're supposed to light outside of the store, the owner of the store is not liable. Very Rube Goldbergish type of way of man. And that's all it says about Hanukkah. The Gemara has a few blot about Hanukkah, but the Mishnah doesn't. And one of the mysteries is, why is Hanukkah so de-emphasized in the Mishnah? And this is a very famous question that scholars and Meforshim and Talmidei Chachamim, both academic scholars and Talmidei Chachamim, grapple with this question. And I'll just give you a few answers, and you'll see how this connects to the overall theme here. And that is, one answer is that Hanukkah was a very dangerous holiday to talk about in Roman times. Because what does Hanukkah celebrate? The overthrow of the Greek rule over Eretz Yisrael, the overthrow of foreign domination so we could have our own country to keep the Torah. Well, I'm living in Roman times, which destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, and Rome is ruling over Eretz Yisrael. And I light Hanukkah candles. And some Roman guy says, what are you doing? He says, oh, we're celebrating the overthrow of foreign powers who conquer Eretz Yisrael. That's what you're doing. You know, the Romans could have regarded the whole Hanukkah holiday as an open invitation to revolution.
And that is why Hanukkah was very quiet. It was low-key. That's why the Gemara, in fact, says, in those days, instead of lighting outside, it was a sakana, they lit inside. The sakana is antagonizing the Romans. But there's a deeper reason. And the deeper reason is, Hanukkah is not about political freedom, and it's not about Jewish skill in war, although the Maccabim were very, very skillful warriors to be able to defeat a world-class army like the Greeks. But Hanukkah is about Mesiras Nefesh, for Torah, for Avodas Hashem, for not giving in to pressures, for being willing to give your life, Al Kiddush Hashem. It is about the triumph of Ruchnius. As the Al-Hanisim prayer says, Hashem delivered the strong into the hands of the weak, the many into the hands of the few, the impure into the hands of the pure, the Rishayim into the hands of Torah. It is the triumph of the light of Torah above everything else in the world. That's what Hanukkah celebrates. But what happened is this. In many, many ways, Hanukkah turned out to be a failure and a great disappointment. Because what happened? The Chashmonaim, who were great, great tzaddikim, overthrew the Greek rule of Eretz Yisrael, and they established their own Malchus. This was Malchus Chashmonai, which lasted for around 150 years until the Romans moved in and conquered Eretz Yisrael. But what was strange is, and those of you that may remember this from high school, perhaps, probably not, if you made Aliyah later, if you went to high school in the States, you may have read George Orwell's Animal Farm. Now, Animal Farm is a parody of the Russian Revolution, where the animals rebel to overthrow the oppressive human masters. But what happened is that the animals become as bad or worse as the very people they tried to overthrow. And this is how revolutions often work. The one who tries to overthrow becomes dictatorial. This is the paradox. The Chashmonaim fought against Hellenism and assimilation. The Chashmonaim eventually became Hellenists and assimilators. And they became persecutors of the Chachamim. There were the Chashmonaim kings, not the original ones, who actually killed many Chachamim, forcing them to go into hiding and the like. So by the time the Mishnah is written, Rav Yehuda HaNasi doesn't automatically see Hanukkah as a great, great cause of celebration. It reminds us of a potential, but that potential was not realized. It's a paradox of history. In fact, just to give you a small example of the paradox, you know, Israel has the Maccabiah Games. Now, the Maccabiah Games, again, I have nothing against it per se, you know, it's a good thing, but the Maccabiah Games is named after the Maccabim, and it's designed to be an imitation of the Olympics. Well, part of what the Maccabim were rebelling against was Greek culture, so we take the Maccabees and we connect it to a ceremony that was based on Greek culture. You know, again, I have nothing against it per se, but it's an interesting juxtaposition, you know, one to think about. It's taking something very holy and kind of using it in an opposite way. Another example, which is by analogy, there's a song that I remember learning as a little child. Mi yamalel gvoros Yisrael, who can count the heroic, this was a Hanukkah song, the heroic exploits of the Jews. Hein b'chol dor yokum ha-gibor, I won't sing it for you, but in every generation arises the mighty one, goel ha'am. This is a song we sang with a lot of gusto, a lot of enthusiasm. One has to realize this song has its genesis in absolute kafira, because this was taken from a pasuk in Tehillim, Mi yamalel gvuros Hashem. Who can say, who can describe the might of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And there were secular people who did not want Hanukkah to be about praising Hashem. So they took the words of David HaMelech and they took out Hashem and they put in the heroism of Yisrael,
that has a gibor, a mighty person, who is the Goel Ha'am. We believe there's no person that is a Goel Ha'am. Goel, certainly we praise and we admire the people that were Hashem Shaluchim, but the idea of a person being a Goel, I don't want to say I know for sure, I have to check Tanakh, but I believe that there is no place in Tanakh, I might be wrong, there is no place in Tanakh, in Megillas Rus, it's called the Goel, but that's referring to a specific context of marrying. But in terms of redeeming from Milchama, it is only Hashem that is called the Goel. So that song, you know, it is especially offensive in retrospect because it takes the words of David HaMelech describing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it just puts it down to human beings. So that's another example of appropriating the sacred. So kids sing this. I mean, we sang this song. It was not considered religiously offensive, but it has a very, very poisonous root in many, many ways. So Hanukkah is about not war and not victory and not even independence. Hanukkah is about spiritual triumph. And that's why it's especially relevant to living in a society of secularism and assimilation. You know, in the beginning of Bereishis, the Torah says, Ha'aretz ha'isa sayhu v'vayu v'chayshech al p'nei tahom. The world was tayhu and vayu, confused and empty, almost contradictory, and there was darkness al p'nei tahom, on the face of the depth. And the Ruach Elokim, the Spirit of Hashem, Mirachefes, was hovering al p'nei hamayim. Listen to what the Medrash says. The Medrash says, in this pasuk, there is a remez to the four exiles that the Jewish people will go through until the coming of Mashiach. The world was desolate, tohu, desolate. That is the Malchus of Babylonia that destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and made the world desolate. Vayu is understood as confused. That refers to Haman. That's the second Malchus. Because who took over Babylonia? Persia. And the Megillah itself says, Ha'ir Shushan Nevocha, people were confused when Ahasuerus decrees that this whole nation is going to be killed. So desolation is Babylonia. Confusion is Persia. Choshech, darkness, is Greece, Antiochus, and al p'nei tahom, on the face of the depth, is the gullus of Rome, because that is the longest gullus, that is the deepest gullus, that is the gullus that still lasts today. You understand, technically, we are in the fourth gullus, the gullus of Rome. Ah, you'll ask Akasha, we're not ruled from anyone in Italy. There is no Roman Empire. But the Mefarshim say we're in the Gullus of Rome, either because Roman philosophy and Roman law and Roman language, and alphabet, is still the cornerstone of Western civilization. So Western civilization does come from the Roman Empire. And also Rome became the seat of Christianity, and most of Jewish life was subject to the Christian church, and still is to some ways. So we are still called Gullus Edom. Now I will say, the Ibn Ezra actually says, the Ibn Ezra has a different calculation. The traditional calculation of the four exiles are Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and Rome. And by the way, they are reflected in Ma'os Tzur, where there's a stanza starting from Mitzrayim, which is pre, but Babel, Persia, Greece, and Rome. And that's how Chazal understand the four exiles. But the Ibn Ezra has a different explanation. The Ibn Ezra understands that Greece and Rome are one gullus, one long gullus, and the fourth gullus is Yishmael, being under the power of the Arab nations, Islam, which actually makes a lot of sense in light of Islamic fundamentalism, oil, and Islamic terrorism and everything else. So we have a machlokas. Are the four exiles Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and Rome? Or the four exiles, Babylonia, Persia, Greece, Rome, and Yishmael. But Chazal do not count, it's a good question, Chazal do not count Yishmael as a separate gullus. And we're in Gullus Edom, the gullus of Esav. And Chazal say that these four exiles are merumaz in the pasuk, Haaretz Hayisatayu, desolate, Babel, Bayu, confused, Persia, Choshech, darkness, Yavan, Alpnei Tahom, deep, 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 and apparently unending, is the gullus of Esav, the gullus of Eden. This is a medrash. The Maharal explains in a bit more detail why each of these phrases is especially relevant to that gullus. The Jewish people face many, many dangers from gullus. The first danger, the first thing that we experience, is servitude. We become enslaved. We lose our independence. We lose our Beis HaMikdash. We're exiled from our land. That is what Babel did. Babel did all of that. Babel enslaved us. They destroyed the temple. They took away our ability to live in Eretz Yisrael, etc. That's called desolation. The second danger we face is physical genocide. That is what Persia tried to do in the guise of Haman. Persia didn't destroy the Beis HaMikdash. If anything, they originally gave permission to go back. But the Golos event of Malchus Paras was the Gezerah of Haman, genocide. Now, Greece is a totally different problem. The Greeks did not try to destroy us physically, but the Greeks created Choshech. Now, what is the characteristic of Choshech? Choshech doesn't take anything away from you, but Choshech takes away your ability to see what it is that you have. And that was the Nisayon of Yavan. The Nisayon of Yavan was, we were living in Eretz Yisrael. We had a Beis HaMikdash. We could serve Hashem initially. But because of Greek culture and literature and athleticism and Hellenism, our eyes were blinded to what we had. This is even before Antiochus. One has to understand, the problem of Hellenism was not created by Antiochus. Antiochus, by his gezeros, brought it to the fore. But Hellenism had been going on for 200 years. You have to remember, the Chashmonoim were a small minority of Am Yisrael. And many of the Jews thought the Chashmonoim were kooks. They were crazy. They were fanatics. Again, it has a certain resonance to how we people sometimes regard religious Jews today. The Chashmonoim did not have the support of most of Am Yisrael. Most of Am Yisrael said, let's go with the agenda. So the gullus of Yavan, says the Maharal, is not a gullus from your land. We were in our land. It's not even a gullus from the Beis HaMikdash, because initially we had the Beis HaMikdash. It was a gullus internally. We were blinded by the beauties of Yefes, of Yavan, and as a result, we didn't appreciate what we had. We were in darkness. Now, we then come to the Roman gullus. Now, the Roman gullus, the Maharal says, Rome is like Japan. What do I mean? They say about the Japanese, they never make anything new, or the Chinese for that matter, but they take every good idea that somebody else came up with, and they can mass produce it. Right? The wealth of China comes from taking other people's things and mass producing it. The Maharal says, the Romans were not an original people. Everything the Romans do, they took from somebody else, including how to do gullus. And that is, the three gulluses, one is enslavement, genocide, and cultural assimilation. In the Roman gullus of 2,000 years, the Jews go through each of those three stages. There are times that we've had desolation and enslavement. There are times like the Holocaust and the Crusades where we face genocide. And there are times like today, in most places in the world at least, where the issue is not genocide, although in Eretz Yisrael we sometimes face this, but the issue is cultural assimilation. To go along, we first said about the 19th century Jew that we're the opposite of the Muranos. The Muranos of Spain were Goyim on the outside and Jews on the inside. But in modern society, Baruch Hashem, we're able to be Jews on the outside. But what are we on the inside? How much of our values come from Torah? So, the Maharal says, the way you understand Golos Edom is,
In Galus Edom, there is the Babylonia within Edom. There is the Persia within Edom. There is the Yavan within Edom. In other words, each of the three have their place in Galus Edom. And if we had to define what Nisayon most of us are in, most of us are in the Yavan of Edom. So really, although we're not in Galus Yavan, we are facing the Nisayon of Galus Yavan in our Galus Edom. Now again, Eretz Yisrael, because of our unique and difficult security issues, we also face the threats to physical life as well, and we hope and pray that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should always be Matzel Eretz Yisrael and Am Yisrael from these sakanas. So unfortunately, we have a little of the other one too. But by and large, the day-to-day Iker Nisayon that we face is the Nisayon of Yavan. So this is Yavan Sheba Edom, right? There's Bavel Sheba Edom, there's Paras Sheba Edom, there's Yavan Sheba Edom. And the morale says, Galus Edom has nothing unique about it. It is just a consolidation of all of the other stages of Galus put into a longer and more intense time period. That's why I compare it to the Japanese and the Chinese. It takes Galus and kind of, you know, mass produces it all over the world and the like. Now, the problem with Galus Yavan is the following, though. Galus Yavan is especially very, very difficult. Lubavitcher Rebbe once made a cute remark. He said that it was easier to be from in Siberia than suburbia. And of course, he was in both places. Well, not personally, but he was aware. And his point was this. When Jews are persecuted and rejected, as difficult as that is, usually you find that religious life flourishes. Talk about Poland, talk about the great Kehillos in Europe, although after World War I there was great assimilation as well. But there is a concept that when the Umos HaOlam reject you, we turn inward to Hashem because we know He's our only salvation. Paradoxically, the greatest danger the Jew faces is when the Umos HaOlam say, become one of us, adopt our culture. That's why, for example, even the Reform movements did not begin till the beginning of the 19th century, when after the French Revolution, there was a phenomenon called emancipation going on in Western Europe initially, in which Jews were given citizenship. They were liberated from the ghettos. They could go to college, they could go to university. All of that is wonderful stuff. The result of those wonderful things was the Reform movement and the Haskalah, as opposed to when Jews were confined in the ghettos, right? I mean, 250 years ago, or 300 years ago, if you were, at least for a man, again, women have a different issue, this is deserving of its own talk, if you were a bright, smart person, all you could do was go to yeshiva and become a Talmud Chacham. You couldn't be a doctor, you couldn't do anything else. As a result, you know, almost by default, people were steered into intensive Torah learning. Once the opportunities become unlimited, at that point it's very harder, you know, it's harder to keep people down. So Yavan is especially pernicious, because although in Antiochus' case it culminated in coercion, but again, I want to repeat this point, the attraction of Hellenism by and large was not coercion. Many, many Jews, most of the Jews, opted into it voluntarily because they liked it. It gave them acceptance, it gave them prestige, it gave them an outlet for their creative talents in ways that they thought they weren't getting within Yiddishkeit. It was not, in other words, don't get the impression all the Jews were keeping mitzvos until Antiochus came along. This was the culmination of 200 years of great assimilation. But what is especially difficult is with Hellenism is it's not all bad, and that's where you get into a problem. You know, they say that the hardest addiction to beat is food addictions. You know, some people claim they have addictions to food. And the reason a food addiction is extremely difficult to break is because you can't go cold turkey, no pun intended, with that. Meaning, when it comes to drinking, an alcoholic could eventually train himself through therapy and the like not to drink. But if one has an addiction to food, they still have to eat. And it is much harder to do something and not become addicted than if you're simply not doing it at all. Well, the same thing is true with culture. The Maharal says a beautiful point. Yavan is descended from Yefes. Yefes is Noach's third son. No, Yefes got a bracha from Noach. The bracha of Yefes was Yaft Elokim liYefes v'yishkain bialei shem. Yaft Elokim liYefes is interpreted to mean God has given the capacity for beauty to Yefes. Beauty is a beautiful thing. Beauty refers to culture, to art, to aesthetics, even to an appreciation of the human form, which is really a magnificent creation of God. And all of these gifts, aesthetics, literary expression, science, which looks in, right, the foundations of science were laid down in Greek culture. Mathematics certainly was. Euclid was essentially the inventor of the science of geometry, or the mathematics of geometry. Ad kedei kach that, 250 years ago, the Vilna Gaon commissioned one of his students to translate Euclid's Elements into Hebrew. You can actually get this as a sefer. It's a translation of Euclid that was authorized by the Vilna Gaon. So the pshat is the following. God gave Yefes these blessings and these talents, and they are described as beautiful. And God then said, Noach said through Hashem, the Yishkain, and these talents shall dwell in the tents of shame. Now in English it doesn't sound so good, but shame is Noach's son, and shame is of course the ancestor of Avraham Avinu, and shame represents that aspect of Noach, which is Ruchnius, Avodas Hashem. The word Semite, as you know, comes from shame. In other words, we are Semitic people because although Avram is the first Jew, so to speak, but he comes from shame. Shame gave him that Yerusha of Emunah and Hashem. So what is the Pasuk telling me? The Pasuk is actually telling me that all of the beauty and wisdom and talent of Yefes should be in the tents of shame. We should enjoy it. We can learn from it. We can be elevated by it. We can be inspired by it to some degree. This is the statement of Chazal. Chachma bagoyim. If they tell you there is wisdom among the nations, ta'amin. So yishkein bi'alei shem is actually saying that a Torah-connected personality should in fact learn from the chachmos of the worlds and should cultivate an appreciation of beauty and art and literature. But there is another connotation of yishkein bi'alei shem. Yishkein bi'alei shem is both saying that the chachma of Yavan shall find a place in the tents of shame, but it's also making the point we have to bring the Yavan into the tents of shame and not bring the shame into the tents of Yavan. Meaning to say, as Rav Hirsch explains, the chachmas of Yavan have to be utilized as a way to enhance our service of Hashem and not as a way to escape our service of Hashem. It's all a question of priorities. Whether you call it Torah im derech eretz, or whether you call it Torah umada, and I'm not going to get into the many pulpulim within Yeshiva University and Toro and those other places, whether those are different ideas or not, that's not so important for our purposes. But one has to know these are not two equal things, but rather we can use the chachmas of Yavan to enhance our love for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But we have to remember that these are a means to an end. They don't become an end to itself. And that is why Yavan is so difficult. Because if it could simply be a matter of a cold turkey type of situation, so forget about it. But if the pshat is we're supposed to connect to it on some level, but we have to connect to it in such a way that it doesn't undermine our ruchnius. That's a much harder avodah. Now, obviously what I'm saying, not everybody would agree with. I mean, there are going to be people that say, you know, the geisha world or the secular world is totally invalid. I want nothing to do with it. And in a way, that's a position that's worthy of respect, because essentially they understand that the sakana is so great, they don't want to be connected. But even though that's a very good, understandable position, one has to understand it's not an optimal position. It is the lesser of two evils. Now, there's one can make a judgment that if connecting to that world will endanger me or my children, I have to separate from that world. And I understand, but one shouldn't say that that's the best thing to do. The best thing would somehow be the idea of connecting, but at the same time understanding how to take it and understand. Now, it could be that most of us are not capable of that, and Einu Chinami, I'm not poskening on that particular issue. Each person has to come to their own hachra, but I do ask you to remember the pasuk, Yavdel Kim Liefes, V'yishkin B'Yolei Shem, and there is no question that when a person can appreciate the beauty in the world and even the complexities of science, it is very, very possible to use that as a springboard to have a deeper, richer relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and be inspired with love of Hashem and reverence for Hashem because of the beautiful Bria that He created. And if one is shutting themselves off from that, there might be something that's missing in that approach. Now, I just want to point out, you know, it says in Pirkei Avos that if a person is learning and he stops learning and he says, Ma noya ilan zeh, how beautiful is this tree? So Pirkei Avos says, Mischayev benafsho, he's chayev misa. What's he doing? Admiring nature? He's supposed to be learning. So that you might say, well, this means, you know, you're not supposed to look at a tree. So in the Chassidish Svarim, it says a beautiful pshat. You know why he's chayev misa? Because in his looking of a tree, he stopped learning. He didn't regard looking at the tree as a chelek of how he serves Hashem. If, however, he looks at the tree and says, Ma rabu masacha Hashem, he's not mafsik mi mishnasai. So in such a case, it's a wonderful, it's a beautiful pshat, that the problem is he dichotomized, you know, which is actually an interesting issue. I mean, again, Eretz Yisrael is so different. I'm still talking from a Gola perspective. But you know, in the Gola and Chutz La'aretz, one of the issues that yeshiva high schools have is, should we try to get religious secular teachers or non-religious secular teachers? It's actually a bit of a personnel dilemma. Some have argued that if we want to create the model that the only thing a Ben Torah should do is learn, we don't want to have a frum mathematics teacher. Because a frum mathematics teacher would be conveying to the students, you can be a frum mathematics teacher. We don't want to tell our students, you can be a frum mathematics teacher. We only want our students to be in kollel, so we have to get a goy to be a mathematics teacher. There is such a shita. Get not from people. On the other hand, that's looking at secular studies as a break in your avodas Hashem. We learn, and then we stop. But there's another approach, in which even within the secular chachmas, you try to connect it to avodas Hashem. You do science, and you can emphasize the wonders of the Ribono Shel Olam. History, you can talk about hashgacha pratis. Mathematics, you can give the kids sugyas and maseches sukkah that are based on mathematics. In other words, instead of kind of saying, you know, we learn, again, in Eretz Yisrael, it's not sonoga except in Bagriyot, but instead of saying we learn from 9 to 12, and then we stop from whatever it is, 12 to 4, 12 to 3, you kind of make it a chelek of the limud as well, in which case you bedafka want to try shomer mitzvahs and even people who learn. By the way, Rav Pam, the great reshiva of Tor V'das, as a young man, he gave a high school shir in the morning and he actually taught algebra in the afternoon. So Rav Pam actually was a math teacher in Tor V'das at the same time. Even when he was Rosh Hashiva, he would sometimes help Bacharim with math homework. He would say, oh, can I help you on that? You know, he was such a Baal Chesed, he was willing to do that as well. Okay, so this is kind of the difficulty that all of us grapple with, and the emes is, it goes back to Yaakov Avinu. In last week's Parsha, we read
that Yaakov Avinu meets up with Esav after 36 years of absence. And the Medrash actually comments that maybe Yaakov shouldn't have initiated contact. The Medrash actually says, you know, it's 36 years. Esav doesn't even have to know you're coming home. Just don't say anything. The Medrash actually compares it to pulling on the ears of a dog that's sleeping. You know, if a dog is sleeping, even a nice, friendly dog, you know, they get irritated, as we do. When somebody wakes you up rudely, we tend not to bite. The dog will probably bite if you pull its ears while it's sleeping. And the Medrash compares Yaakov initiating contact to Esav to trying to wake up a sleeping dog. Okay. Be it as it may, however, once Yaakov made the contact, so Chazal say, Yaakov took three steps, three strategies to deal with Esav. Plan A was to send him gifts and be obsequious, obedient, friendly, well, you know, welcoming, etc. Deal with him in a very positive way. Plan B is, if Chas V'Shalom that doesn't work, I'm ready to fight. And plan C, which of course is necessary for everything, is to turn to the Ribbono Shel Olam in tefillah, that he should give you hatzlacha and bracha in whatever way you want to go. So there's doron, gift giving, milchama, a war, and tefillah. So I would like to suggest B'derech Drush, along the lines of Maisa Avais, Simen Labanim, that these three steps are not only how we deal with the physical threat of Esav, but these are also three steps in how we deal with the secular culture that Golos Edom via Yavan, right? The Yavan Shebe Edom, the Yavan Shebe Esav, is threatening us with. And that is, in Klal Yisrael, you sometimes have opposite approaches. There are those people who reject everything that is not within the Dalet Amos of the Beis HaMedrash. Although I do want to point out that even people who purport to reject everything, I mean, they use a telephone invented by the Presbyterian minister Alexander Graham Bell. You know, so to say that I don't do anything outside of Torah is not quite Emes. But be it as it may, they want to reject anything outside of Torah. So we can symbolically call that waging war. They wage war against anything Esav brings to the table. That's one approach. Milchama, not physical war, not throwing stones necessarily, but anything outside of that is treif, puzzle, I don't want it. There is the opposite approach of gift giving, in which, like, everything out there is good, I want to embrace everything. What Yaakov is suggesting is that in our approach to the secular, to the non-Torah, so to speak, you're not supposed to be a total milchama, nor are you supposed to be a total acceptance. You combine both derachim at once, and in order to give you the judgment to determine what is good and what is bad, you need a lot of siyata dishmaya through the koach of tefillah. Let me remind you, Motzei Shabbos, we recite Atachan Antonu in the Amidah, in the Shemona Esrei of Ma'ariv. And that's called Havdalah. That is a Havdalah in Shemona Esrei. If a woman doesn't have a Ma'ariv, she has to say Baruch HaMavdil, otherwise she can't light the Havdalah candle. Now, the Gemara asks the Kashi in Brachos, why is the Atachan Antonu in the fourth Bracha of Shemona Esrei? Why is it there? And the answer is, the fourth bracha deals with what is called das. We ask Hashem for wisdom and understanding. And the Gemara says, without das, havdalah minayin. Das is the ability to discriminate, to understand the difference between kodesh l'chol, between or l'choshech. That's das. Meaning, people who say everything's bad or everything's good are not making Havdalah. They lack Das. Das is the discriminatory capacity to understand that much in the world is not all bad or all good, but things are in mixtures and one has to try to be able to separate. And only through tefillah, let me say why tefillah is so good too, it's not just a question, of course, on one level, it's Siyata Dishmaya, of course. Without Siyata Dishmaya, nothing happens, of course. But there's something even a little bit deeper. Rav Hirsch points out that the Shairish of the word Lehispalel is Pei Lamed Lamed. Now, Pei Lamed Lamed is not a Shairish that means prayer. It's a Shairish that means judgment. Judges are called Palilim. So, Palel is to judge. Lehispalel is reflexive, like Lehis Rachetz is to wash myself. So the literal translation of Lehis Palel does not mean to pray, but it means to engage in a process of self-judgment, evaluation, and introspection. In other words, tefillah is about my understanding my place in the world and my dependence on Hashem. The point of tefillah is not to get what you're asking for, actually. The point of tefillah is to understand how much I need Hashem for my health, I need Hashem for my wisdom, I need Hashem for my parnasa. And the reason prayer works is not because you're changing Hashem's mind. Prayer works by engaging in that process of self-transformation. You're a different person. If Hashem was Gozer, that Mr. or Mrs. X is not deserving of certain things, so how does davening change that? Because Mr. or Mrs. X are no longer Mr. or Mrs. X. They're now X squared, or X whatever it would be. Hashem's Gezer actually didn't change, but Hashem's Gezer was on somebody who was here. And davening can put me here. Different person. Different gezeirah. Right? It's not that Hashem changes. I change. And Rav Hirsch says that is nichlal in the word lehispalel. So lehispalel helps us understand ourselves. And when I understand myself, my family, myself, I can then make the judgment what to accept, what to reject. Because I can get das. When there's das, there's havdalah. And this is kodesh l'chol or l'chayshech. Yisrael la'amim, all of these things. And this is why Golas Yavan is so pernicious. Golas Yavan is called darkness because it distorts our perception. It doesn't change our reality, but it changes how we view our reality. And that's the worst of all, because you can have everything, but if you don't see it, you don't have it. In this connection, I want to tell you a beautiful, again, drush from Reb Leib Chassman. You know, Yaakov Avinu, the night before, going back to Esav again, the night before he meets Esav in the flesh, he struggles with this mysterious entity that is the guardian angel of Esav. And Yaakov struggles, and it's a long night, and Yaakov is sometimes on top and sometimes at the bottom. And then the morning comes, and this mysterious entity has to leave. And Yaakov is alive, and Yaakov triumphed, and his name is changed to Yisrael. Instead of heel, it's Yisrael. You have triumphed with Hashem. Sarita. But Yaakov is limping on his thigh. And that is why we don't eat the sciatic nerve to remember that encounter. And the Sefer HaChinuch says, by the way, very beautifully, that this is a remez that the Jewish people will have a long, dark gullus. And in that long, dark gullus, we're going to be attacked and threatened in many, many ways. And at the end, Hashem says, there will be a day, there will be a dawn, there will be a redemption. And after that redemption, we'll still be limping. When Mashiach comes, we will have been suffering tremendously. But even the enemy that tried to destroy us will eventually give us a bracha. Right, so the whole story is the reassurance to Am Yisrael. On one hand, it's telling you to be realistic. Don't expect the process to be easy. It's not going to be easy. Don't expect the process will not have suffering. It will have suffering. It will have injuries. There will be casualties. But there will be a dawn and there will be a bracha. That's what the Sefer Chinuch says is the message of this struggle. Before I get to Rav Chasman, I just want to tell you another word from the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim says, though, why the thigh? So he says, Yaakov represents the power of Torah in the world. And the angel of Esav wanted to destroy Torah. He couldn't do it. He couldn't destroy Torah. Am Yisrael will always learn Torah. There'll always be Yechidim, at least, who will learn Torah. No question. But what he wanted to weaken, if he couldn't weaken Torah, he wanted to weaken the financial support of Torah. So just as the thigh supports the body, so Esav had a partial victory. The partial victory is that the financial support of Torah learning will always be shvach. That was the nitzachon of the angel of Esav. And the Chafetz Chaim said, this is based on a Zohar, but the Chafetz Chaim said, ad kedei kach, that if there's any Torah institution that does not have financial problems, one must question how authentic it is, because the sorrow shall Esav made the support of Torah financially precarious. I always tell my Talmid ben Or Sameach that, Baruch Hashem, we have a great, great yeshiva, in that based on that definition at least. Other reasons as well. Now, you might say, Derech Agav, oh, so if a yeshiva comes to me for money, I'm supposed to, hey, you're supposed to be poor. What are you asking me for money? Well, no, that's not a good cheshbon. It's reminiscent of, in the 19th century, when anesthesia was developed for childbirth, there were Christian theologians that said, they're all men, of course, women are not allowed to take anesthesia because the curse of Chava was, you shall suffer in childbirth. So what do we say, Taka? We say that when Hashem creates teva, that's not the same as a mitzvah. In other words, Hashem created a teva that childbirth is painful, but we are permitted to try to mitigate its effects, just like sickness. So the same thing here. Hashem allowed there to be a teva that Hachzakas Torah is going to be shvach, but we still have a chiyuv. In other words, Hashem didn't give a mitzvah, thou shalt keep yeshivas poor. I mean, there's no mitzvah like that. It's the teva shebidvorim. That was the nitzachon. And we're mechuyev to alleviate it to whatever degree we can, even though Hashem is telling us ahead of time, you're not going to be totally successful. But you do, you know, lo alecha amlacha l'gmar. Okay. But the main point I wanted to get back to, connecting it to our overall theme, is that Yaakov then asks the angel, after the angel gives him a bracha, tell me your name. Hagido li ma shemecha. And the angel says, Lama ze tishal lishmi, why are you asking me my name? Rashi explains, the angel doesn't have a fixed name. He says, my name depends on my mission. Every day I have a different mission. Every day I have a different name. I have many names. I don't have a single name. That's what Rashi says. But Rav Leib Chassman, one of the great Gedolei Musar, the Mashgiach of Chevron, he was in Europe and then he was in Chevron, says, no, the angel's name is, why do you ask my name? Remember Eben Costello, who's on first, oh, whatever, but it's the same type of thing. In other words, the angel's name is, why do you ask my name? What type of name is, why do you ask my name? You're going to call your child, why do you ask my name? Is that a name? So he gives the following mashal, which I think fits our Hanukkah story in this sense. The mashal is to a Polish farmer, a guy, who's coming to the big city for the first time, and he never saw a movie. He gets told about a movie. So he says, you know, if you buy a ticket and you sit in this dark room, you'll see people and animals coming out of the wall, even though there's no door. So that's how they explained it to him. So he buys a ticket, he's sitting in a dark room, and all of a sudden, out of that wall comes people and horses and animals. And he didn't understand it. He thought they're walking towards him. Maybe it's a 3D picture or something. And he didn't see a door. And how are they getting in? How are they going through the wall? He didn't know what to do. So he takes out his big flashlight. And he shines it on the wall to get a better look. Is there a secret door? But of course, when you shine a flashlight on a movie, the picture disappears. You can't see it.
So people were yelling at him, shut off your light, we only see the picture when it's dark. Reb Leib Chassman says, although someone pointed out to you, it's very surprising he would use a mashal involving a movie. It actually is a good kasha. But Reb Leib Chassman said that this is a mashal for Olam Hazeh. When you sit in the dark, all sorts of things look real to you, which are not really real. Whether it's money, whether it's power, whether it's accumulating things, whether it's holding grudges. In other words, when you're sitting in the dark, the movie looks real. Because sitting in the darkness, which metaphorically means not thinking about life, not trying to understand why I'm here, all sorts of fake things appear to be the realities of things. But the other side of the coin is, so when it's dark, things that aren't real look real. But the opposite, things that are real, you may not notice. You can have $1 million next to you or some diamonds, you wouldn't even see it. So darkness makes you think that the unreal is real, and it prevents you from seeing the real. When you turn on the lights, the opposite happens. That which is not real disappears, and that which is real is perceived. See, that's the idea of turning on the lights. So Rav Leib Chassman says the following. When Yaakov asks the angel, what is your name? Yaakov is asking the following question. In Kabbalah, and this is in many Chazals as well, a name is the identification of a person's spiritual energy. In fact, in ways we don't fully understand, the Arizal writes, the name that we give our sons at a bris milah, or a daughter for that matter, when she's named at an aliyah l'Torah, is a prophecy from Hashem as to the spiritual nature of that person. So if a person is an Avraham, or a Sarah, or an Esther, or a Moshe, there is something in that person's neshama that has that spiritual goal. Now, we normally don't understand exactly in what way, but a name is the identification of the spiritual power within a person. Ad kidei kach, by the way, that some posts can take the position that even if the name announced at a bris was not the one the parents intended, but that's min hashamayim. I was at a bris once where the grandfather, the mother's father, was the one who was honored with naming the baby. But the grandfather didn't like the name that his children had chosen because he wanted someone in his family. So he just announced a different name. And I still remember hearing a wail from the mechitza. No, you know, I remember kind of a woman crying out. And the Rosh Hashiva that was there actually paskened, Mi Hashem Yotzo Hadavar. I don't know if they talked anymore after that. But again, now I'm not saying that has to be the halacha. There's certainly a very strong basis not to have to do that. But this is ad kedei kach, that it's like a gezeira of Hashem, that this is the name. So, going back to Yaakov. If I understand that the angel of Esav is symbolic of the Yetzer Hara, the Kayach of Ra, Yaakov, when Yaakov asks the angel, what is your name? Yaakov is asking the angel, what is the source of your power over people? How do you trick people to do Averis? How do you confuse them? How do you lead them astray? Because after all, rationally, Averis make no sense at all. Because whatever benefit we get in the short term, we know with 100% certainty that we're not going to come out ahead. Hashem makes the cheshbonos. So, Mashemecha, what's the source of your power over people? The angel's answer is, because nobody bothers to think about it. Nobody asks my name. In other words, people don't think about what's good and what's bad. We just sit in darkness. We're automatic pilot. We're like the person who's sitting in the movie theater. When the lights are off, we think all sorts of things are important. And if we would just turn on the lights, we would understand it. So, what is Chanukah about? Chanukah is about turning on the lights. Remember the first medrash I quoted. Yavan is choshech. You have a Beis HaMikdash, you're in Eretz Yisrael, but you don't appreciate it because other things look more real. And Chanukah is the light that dispels the darkness so you can perceive inner reality, true purpose. And therefore the Chanukah, the dedication, is the dedication of our own soul to Hashem. Right? Dedication of the Beis HaMikdash, but our own neshamas are a Beis HaMikdash. Yovavi Mishkan Efnech. I build a Mishkan, a dwelling place to Hashem, in my own heart. Just want to mention one further thought about this. And that is, people think that, you know, we had this war against Antiochus. By the way, it lasted, the Yevanim had control of the Beis HaMikdash for 3 years. Very interesting. The Yevanim entered the Beis HaMikdash around 188 BCE, and the date that they entered the Beis HaMikdash was the 25th of Kislev. They entered the Beis HaMikdash on the 25th of Kislev. When they entered the Beis HaMikdash, they desecrated it. They put up idols. They sacrificed chazerim on the Mizbeach to Avodah Zarah. They put in prostitution houses in the Beis HaMikdash. For 3 years, we did not have the Beis HaMikdash. But on the 25th of Kislev, it's Mamish Miyom Liyom, on the 25th of Kislev, 3 years later, Yehuda HaMakabi and the Chashmonaim were able to re-enter the Beis HaMikdash to purify it. And that is when the jar of oil was discovered and lasted for 8 days. 3 years, miyom liyom. This part of the story everybody knows. But what a lot of people don't know is the regaining of the Beis HaMikdash and the miracle of the oil was not the end of the war. We regained the Beis HaMikdash. But there was a war against Antiochus for another 20 years. The Hasmonean dynasty was not established until many years later. The nace of Chanukah was not at the end of the war. It was within 3 years of the war. But I think if you think about this, this makes the nace so much more beautiful and meaningful. Because here is the thing. A small group of Jews, it's not even a majority of Am Yisrael, are engaged in this struggle against the most powerful nation in the world, a world empire. Most of the Jewish people aren't even supporting what they're doing. They consider them fanatics and obstructionists and whatever it would be. And if you were a Chashmonai at the time, you might think any given day, what's the use of our struggle? Why do we go on day after day after day after day? There's so little that we can do. There's so little that we can accomplish. Good, we don't have to assimilate, but let's go into the caves and the mountains and just hide ourselves and do our mitzvahs privately. What's the tachlis of fighting? How can we possibly overcome these numbers, these odds, this power? So Hashem sends them a message in the middle of the war where a little bit of oil that can only last one day manages to burn 8 days. What is that message? Listen to the message they're hearing. You do what you can in this world, even if you think it's hopeless, even if you think it's meaningless, even if you think it's not going to achieve anything, but when you do what you can, I will give a bracha to your efforts beyond the normal, beyond the natural. And they get that message and they hear it. And they say, we can go on. We will keep on going. I think it's much more powerful. You know, if this would have just been at the end of the war, it really would have been, you know, frosting on the cake. Baruch Hashem, we won a war, we have our country back, we have a malchus, and gee, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a miracle as well. This is a totally different perspective. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling you, don't be afraid of numbers. Lo b'chayov, lo b'koach. Success in the world is not based on your strength and it's not based on your numbers. Hashem can take the most insignificant number and person and create great things. And that is a message for all of us. The world is filled with darkness in many, many ways. We have the darkness of violence, the darkness of assimilation, the darkness of hedonism. And each of us, in our own way, have an ability to light a little bit of light in the world. But on the other hand, we might think to ourselves, who am I? Like I'm nobody. Whatever little light I can do will certainly be overwhelmed in the darkness. It'll go out soon. My candle really can't last. But now the Jews could have thought that even by the Hanukkah menorah. You know, they might have thought, listen, we only have one day of oil. We're not going to get new oil for another 8 days. What's the use of lighting this? You know, it's not going to last. And if they wouldn't have lit, there wouldn't have been a miracle. So what's Hanukkah about? You do what you can, even if it doesn't seem to make a difference. And then Hashem opens up the doors. That's a message that goes beyond the Chashmonaim. That's a message that applies to each and every one of us every single day of our lives. How often do we desist from doing a mitzvah, from welcoming somebody, from even on a given day? We feel, sometimes a person feels inspired to learn something or to daven something. But then a person thinks, well, you know, I'm not going to do it tomorrow. So like, why start? Why should I do something that I'm not going to be able to continue? Hanukkah says, every minute you have an opportunity. Seize that minute. Use that opportunity. And then you never know the gates that Hashem is going to open by taking that first step. So, going back to my remarks, the Reform movement in America at one point tried to make Hanukkah as important as December 25. They then moved the other way and tried to emphasize how unimportant Hanukkah is. Well, whatever they decide one way or the other is not a psak halacha. But Hanukkah is very, very important. Very beautiful, very powerful, very meaningful. And it really teaches us not to give up hope and to understand that the little light that we light can still generate much, much light in all the darkness of the world. So I wish everyone a happy and joyous Hanukkah, and may it be a true season of rededication. Thank you.